Hey there, if you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Welcome everyone to the Crime Off the Grid podcast. I'm Tara.
And I'm Nancy.
And we are really excited today because we have a very special guest. Joining us is Andrea Lankford, and she is a former National Park Service Ranger who's worked in Cape Hatteras National Seashore, Zion National Park, Yosemite National Park, and Grand Canyon National Park. As a park ranger, Andrea wore many hats as a firefighter, law enforcement officer, and performed wilderness emergency medical services as a park medic. Andrea eventually left the National Park Service and worked as a private duty concierge registered nurse. She's the author of 5 nonfiction books, including 3 trail guides, which the one I'm excited to read about is called Haunted Hikes, Spine Tingling Tales and Trails. She also wrote Ranger Confidential, Living, Working, and Dying in the National Parks. She's also written for High Country News, Arizona Highways, and Backpacker. Her latest book, Trail of the Lost, The Relentless Search to Bring Home the Missing Hikers of the Pacific Crest Trail, was an instant New York Times bestseller, and the book we'll be focusing on today. So welcome, Andrea.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're so excited that you're joining us. It's really great to have you here.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to talk to you guys about all this crazy stuff that's going on in the woods out there.
Well, right.
It is crazy.
Yeah. You know, we had never crossed paths while you were in the National Park Service, but we have several mutual friends, and I have always known your name. And the National Park Service is really a small world. But after reading your book, this recent book, Nancy and I just were talking about it, and we're so honored that you were able to carve out some time because you are a very busy woman.
Yeah, I'm trying to wind it down, but it keeps chasing me.
Well, again, thank you very much. And I did want to bring up to start off here a little bit. You worked as a park ranger in 2 of the most iconic national parks, Grand Canyon and Yosemite. And in both of those parks, you wore a lot of different hats, as we just said. Besides being busy with law enforcement incidents, both of those parks are well known for search and rescue operations. And during your time in those parks, you had, I don't know if it's safe to say, maybe more search and rescue experience than most rangers, at least more than me, might get in other parks. And I understand that in Grand Canyon, you were instrumental with a team in creating a program that would hopefully reduce or prevent lost or injured person incidents. And I don't know if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, when I was at the Grand Canyon, I was the corridor district ranger. I was in charge of the most popular trails that go from the south rim to the north rim. And just my district alone, one year we had 285 search and rescue missions. The park, it was the park was over 300 and something. So that's got to make it one of the busiest search and rescue units in the nation, if not the world. And the one year that I was supervising there, it was the deadliest hiking season on record. We had 8 hikers die in one year and 22 people died in the park. We knew that it was too many people were dying and we needed to make a change. And so we got together as a team, as a task force, and came up with a PSAR, Preventative Search and Rescue Program. And we worked hard on it. And right away after we implemented it in the late 90s, it was showing success. People weren't dying. There were fewer rescues. And from then to now, they're still doing that program. It's grown a lot and it's saving lives, I have no doubt. And so I'm very proud to have been a part of that in the 90s.
What does PSAR entail?
It can be multi-pronged. We did a lot of public service announcements. It can be ads in magazines. It can be radio ads. Today it would be on social media, for example. We also knew we needed to be even more aggressive in that we were going to do something new. We were going to put rangers on the trail every day, face-to-face, telling hikers what they needed to do to safely hike in the Grand Canyon. And I personally think that was probably the most effective part of the program, was that face-to-face interaction with the rangers. Hard to ignore.
Yeah. I know it's expanded to other parks, not Yellowstone, which it should, but it has expanded to other parks. that's great to have such a program that has been implemented and continuing today and expanding. So great job.
Yeah, great.
And that's awesome that you guys have made it. You can tell that you made a difference by implementing that program.
I know we did. They've done studies. Independent studies have been done, and you can look at them online, and you will see that since the late 90s, there's been a continuous decrease in search and rescue and deadly incidents in the backcountry of Grand Canyon.
So, Andrea, tell us about your new book, Trail of the Lost.
Well, I guess I'll tell you, you know, I guess I don't find stories. Stories find me. And in 2017, I heard about a hiker that had gone missing while hiking the Pacific Crest Trail in 2015. His name was Chris Sylvia. He was 28 years old, and he was single. And he was living in a friend's apartment, kind of struggling like a lot of 28-year-olds are. And immediately, his case reminded me of a case I'd worked at the Grand Canyon in 1995 of another young man in his 20s who went missing while hiking in Grand Canyon National Park. Now, I was in charge of coordinating the operation, the search operations, and we searched for him for days, and I failed to find this young man. And I was talking to his father every day in the command post, and I got close to his father. And we had an emotional moment where it became apparent we were going to wind down the search effort. That case has haunted me for decades. So fast forward 20 years later, I hear about the Chris Sylvia case. He reminds me of the earlier case, and I can't let it go. I contact his family and ask for their blessing to start investigating his case pro bono. Now, I'm not a park ranger anymore. I am a registered nurse at this time, and I'm still working as a nurse. But I just couldn't let the case go. And once I started digging into it, then stuff started to happen, and it became apparent this story was much bigger than just one case of a missing hiker on the Pacific Crest Trail.
So that's what got you started in the search on the PCT for those hikers?
Yeah.
Is the incident in the Grand Canyon?
That was what inspired me to take the case. You know, you guys have searched for missing hikers too, right? Especially if you don't find them. You're haunted by that. You can't sleep over it. You cry over it. These poor families, it's the worst thing that can happen to a family is to have a loved one, especially a child, go missing and have no idea what happened to them.
Right. Well, Nathan and I were talking before the podcast today about, since we both worked in Yellowstone and some of our searches that we've been on, and we had a theme. And most of our searches, it seems like, people went missing in water, and they went missing in rivers, and they go missing in lakes. And Yellowstone has crazy rivers, very swift and very, very cold water. And most of the searches that I have been on did not result in finding anybody.
Yeah, that goes with me too. Most of the ones that I've been on, the majority of them were water incidences, and never found the person that we were searching for, unfortunately.
So you're right when you say it really affects you. You don't forget it and you lose sleep over it. It's definitely a true statement.
Yes. And then at Grand Canyon, it was all the above, you know, because we had the Colorado River. And we had worked cases where victims had fallen in the water or been washed away in a flash flood. I've retrieved bodies, recoveries for people who are washed away in flash floods. But interesting enough, eventually that case, Gabriel Parker was his name, the case in 1995 at the Grand Canyon, he was found by accident. And often that's how some of these cases are eventually solved, is it hunters or scientists or people working on a remote pipeline find something, a clue or a body, and then the case is resolved. So when I started investigating the Chris Sylvia case, at that point I had never had a case or worked a case that had not been solved. In most cases, you guys, you know, you have these water cases, but it's actually rare. They say 97% of overdue hiker cases are resolved within 24 to 48 hours. It's really rare for these cases to be unsolved, you know, over time. Like I said, it may be a year or 2 years for when someone's accidentally found.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also some of the searches that we've been on, like in Yellowstone, like I said before, it's not really considered a big SAR park. So a lot of those people who do go missing or lost, they are found very quickly. So they're almost like a nothing. Like you find them in a hasty search or you find them in a bastard search pretty quickly. So they just haven't been the ones that have been very prolonged, or at least I have not been on very many of those.
Yes, and that's my experience as well. Most in those cases, they don't even stick in your mind, or at least not that originally it was a missing hiker case. That doesn't stick in your mind. It just becomes a recovery or a rescue in your mind.
Right, yep.
Well, it sounds like really you were the perfect person to take on the case of Chris Sylvia. And I know you have so much other experience hiking. You through hiked the Appalachian Trail. And so you know what it takes to complete that. And in general, you know, you think of through hikers being very prepared, and you talk about the gear and trip planning down to the exact number of miles, and everybody wants to shed even ounces of weight off of their pack. And I talked to a ranger actually in Grand Canyon who said, you know, he was down to lighten his load. He would take labels off of cans or anything that he had just to lighten his load. But I was surprised after reading your book, you know, you mentioned in a way there's another type of through hiker that's so unprepared with no experience, no hiking or backpacking experience, hoping to fix themselves, find themselves, or leave their old life behind. And it seems like maybe that was the case in at least one of the lost hikers you wrote about searching for.
Yeah, well, for people who aren't familiar, the Pacific Crest Trail runs from the Mexico border through California, Oregon, and Washington State all the way to the Canadian border. And it's 2,653 miles. And through hikers, they're a whole nother culture. They're a little bit different than your average backpacker or hiker that you're going to run into. And it's not uncommon for them to be in a transitionary period in their life. They've had a divorce. Maybe they, you know, me, when I did the Appalachian Trail, yeah. I left the National Park Service. I was burned out, disillusioned. I was in a funk. So I went back to the Appalachian Trail, you know, to heal, basically, to get back to why I love nature. And so I was in my 30s when I did it. I was also seeking a new way of life when I hiked the Appalachian Trail. But I also had a lot of experience. You know, I was a medic and a search. I had a lot of search and rescue experience. So I had experience where a lot of other through hikers do not. Now, one thing people attribute to this, something really big hit the Pacific Crest Trail in the same year that Chris Sylvia went missing, 2015. Do you know what that was? Something major.
Are we talking about a movie?
Yeah, it was a movie.
Which I just watched two nights ago, by the way.
So, a very big movie starring Reese Witherspoon. It was Wild, based on Cheryl Strayed's memoir. Came out in December 2014. So, Chris Sylvia went missing in February 2015, right when everyone was reading this book, Wild. Well, what happened is Wild was it's a wonderful book, an inspiring book, that also inspired a bunch of people to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. And so the numbers of people wanting to hike the trail skyrocketed so much that the Pacific Crest Trail Association had to implement a permit system to manage the use. So it wasn't, you know, thousands of people hitting the trail in one day. And some people aren't happy about that. They call it the Wild effect. But also, not too long after that, we've got social media, Instagram and YouTube and Facebook. So what happens is the Pacific Crest Trail becomes something, not necessarily like a wilderness expedition. It becomes a spiritual pilgrimage. And so people are coming to the trail to grow and redeem themselves, which is great. But if you don't have the backpacking experience behind that, that could cause some problems.
Yeah.
Sure it can. Yep.
Well, because we're a true crime podcast, there's a story that I'd come across a while back in planning cases to cover for Crime Off the Grid. Then I learned you had a connection because of your work trying to find Chris Fowler, David O'Sullivan, and Chris Sylvia. And you discovered or ran across a crime on the PCT that led to learning about so many other victims of this person who turned out to be a serial predator. So I don't know if you would like to discuss this case with us.
Yeah. So after I started investigating the Chris Sylvia case, and I always look for patterns and, you know, what are the hazards in this area? What's going on with the Pacific Crest Trail? And I was joining all the Facebook groups. And very quickly, I learned that Chris Sylvia wasn't the only thru hiker who had vanished from the Pacific Crest Trail. A year later, in 2016, Chris Sherpa Fowler, an experienced hiker, disappeared while hiking the trail in Washington State. And then 6 months after that, in April 2017, David O'Sullivan from Ireland, who's 25 years old, he went missing from the Pacific Crest Trail in Southern California, about 52 miles north of where Chris Sylvia disappeared. So I have three young men, one each year, 3 years in a row, vanished from the same trail, and no one had found them despite numerous efforts to locate them. So what happened is I and others, we were monitoring all the Facebook groups. And that's a new thing with hiker culture is there's Facebook groups about all the trails. And that's a big gossip and chatter spot. But it's also a spot where people share dangers. And we learned that in 2018, in the summer, that another hiker went missing on the PCT. Her name was Kira Moon. She was older. She was in her 60s. And her family was looking for her. It started to become apparent that she was purposely avoiding her family, that she was alive, and she said she was fine, but she wanted her family to leave her alone. So everybody dropped the case, and except for her family, they had her friends. They had a feeling something wasn't right. She was hiking with a new boyfriend, and he was going by the name Jay, or Medic. That was his trail name. We all kind of just went off the radar. We weren't paying attention. Then in September, someone announced on Facebook that Kira Moon had escaped the clutches of this Jay. She had she was in the Bay Area and had jumped out of a he was in, distracted in the store, and so she ran from the store and jumped into a urgent care type place. Told them she was being abused. The cops came, they arrested this Jay, and it turns out his name was Jay Perillo. And that is the individual that you heard about. So maybe you want to fill us in on what you learned about this guy.
Well, I ran across an article by Bill Donahue in Backpacker Magazine, and he wrote about his interview with Kira Moon. So he had a lot of disturbing details about what she went through at the hands of Perillo on the PCT. And he said that Kira told of taking a photo of Perillo, or aka Medic, and wanted to post it. And Perillo told her to wait. And so she waited a week. And when she did post it on Facebook, Perillo went berserk. And at their campsite, or where they were staying far from anyone. And I think this might have been at the time where I think there were fires that went through the area where they were. And they were kind of holed up near an old a ranger station or something like that. But he just screamed at her for hours. He forced her to stare him square in the eyes as he berated her. And then he had this crazy, bizarre excuse for being so mad. And he said that he was gay, and he'd come to the PCT to escape all these pursuers, and that the Navy was after him because he had lied about his sexual orientation. And now the media was after him too, because there was some rumor that he was Caitlyn Jenner's lover. You can't make this stuff up. And now Kira has tipped them off with her Facebook post. "You're ruining my life," he said to her. And then he says, "I come from an Italian family with a lot of dignity, and now you've put a black mark on my family, and I can't go back to them because of you." And that's the weirdest victim blaming I've ever heard of. And that's just one of the many outrageous stories this guy tells. But Kira decides after that incident that maybe she should hike solo. So she tells Perilla this, and he grabbed her by the neck, punched her in the head. He kept beating her while she was on the ground. And Kira told Donahue he had a smirk on his face the whole time, like this was what he had been waiting for, like this was Christmas for him. And she said that Perilla raped her repeatedly. And he confiscated the SIM card from her cell phone, which is why a lot of people could not have heard from her. And that just cut her off from the whole outside world. And each time she talked about leaving him or separating from him, he beat her again. And she said, I knew that if I went against him, he could snap my neck in 2 seconds. And so I was going to ask you, Andrea, you know, when she escaped on September 26th by going to that urgent care facility, she had mentioned that he had beat her so badly, you know, that she thought she'd broken her ribs. And so they took x-rays. There was so much evidence of physical abuse that he had beat her so severely. She had 4 broken ribs. The cops came and arrested him on what it sounds like was just a misdemeanor warrant. And I say, in general, as an aside, good for the cops to arrest somebody like that in whatever they can at the time to help make somebody safe at the time. But please keep doing an investigation. It sounds like there were never charges for domestic violence or any charges for his assaults on Kira. So in my opinion, they really dropped the ball on this one.
They absolutely did. So when the hiker community, when we learned about this, and one of Kira's friend, her name is Brandy Valenza, had done intensive research on James Carrillo, and then I started investigating him as well. He had a long history of doing this stuff, and the FBI was notified. There is a jurisdictional issue. Where he was arrested was in the Bay Area, and probably where the assault occurred was in Southern California. So, you know, some different jurisdictions there. That's not a good enough excuse. Like I said, the FBI wasn't made aware of this. It was a kidnapping. But they did drop the ball. Now, what we learned is that he had been doing this since 1994. He had kidnapped a woman named Valerie Eric. Now, his MO was very much the same. He likes to play upon people's sympathy. So he met Valerie Eric at a gas station somewhere, and he pretended like he was deaf and mute and was writing notes and telling her she was beautiful and charming her. Well, within, you know, after a few days of hanging out with him, suddenly he was cured. And then it came similar stuff. The mafia.
It's a miracle. Right? The mafia was praise the Lord. It's a miracle.
Exactly. Healed. Yeah. You know, her love healed him, right? Yeah. So, and then, of course, then he becomes violent. He smashed her head and, you know, very similar stuff. He did this in 1994. He was never, no justice was occurred for that. He was never arrested for that. Valerie Elric has passed away since then. He has another more criminal history of kidnapping. He did some time for kidnapping in California, or at least a charge related to kidnapping. And what happened is the hiking community was upset because he was going back to trails patrolling for more victims. And so what we would do is a hiker would say, I've seen him here at this mile. And then I would get on my Facebook group, Missing from the PCT, and I would post, Carrillo's been seen. Now, I had pictures of this guy. He's a scary looking guy. He's big. He's muscular. He's got tattoos everywhere. There's pictures of him with guns. He posts threatening things on social media. There's a video of him on YouTube where he's saying he'll stab a cop if he has to. He's not a good dude.
Wow.
Obviously. So what would happen is the hikers, we would warn the other hikers on social media and he would bounce. So he would go from the PCT to the Arizona Trail to the Continental Divide Trail to the last time I heard, he went to the Lost Coast Trail on the coast of California. And last time I heard about him was, I want to say it was 2021. He was on the PCT. Then he went quiet. Then I didn't hear any more about him.
So in 1988, Perillo, who was 22 and it was in Pasadena, California, well, he meets this young woman and she's interning as a youth minister. And so he comes up with this story, again, just another, you know, fabrication, that he was a refugee from the mafia and that they were out to get him and they were looking for him. And so he told her, you know, for your own safety, he thought she should marry him. And she did. And then, you know, of course, he did his normal thing. You know, he beat her, he raped her. At one point, he stole her address book and he forced her to call everyone she knew and beg for money while they traveled across the United States. And that was interesting because I didn't know how they did all this because you need money for gas and right. food and all that. But I guess, you know, he was asking her, you know, to beg her friends and family for money. And at one point he told her, if you leave me, I'll hunt you down and I'll kill everyone in your family. And I too have seen pictures of this guy and he's scary looking.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that these women believed him when he spoke like that, when he said those things to her. So she never reported her abduction to the police. And, but she was able to escape him in 1991. And, she gained the courage, they were at a hotel and she gained the courage to speak to, the front desk at the hotel. And because she snuck out of the room while he was sleeping. They got her outside into a Suburban and she laid on the floor. And then they were able to drive her to the police station so that she could report that she had been kidnapped by Perello. And then when the police came back, Perello was missing. And according to what I read, he vanished into thin air is what they told, you know, what they told in the article. So they never did find him. But then she actually had their marriage annulled in 1993. So she was no longer, you know, married to him after that. But that was a bizarre case. And in my opinion, that might have been, Andrea, one of those times that he was off the trail, that people didn't see him, you know, for a while.
Yeah. Now, one scary thing about him, I've seen the reports, he has the names of several women tattooed on his body.
Oh, wow. I hope
the FBI is looking at those names to see if they correspond with any missing people or, you know, unsolved cases. But he does have the names of women tattooed on his body.
I don't know.
That's what you would call plain view, right?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound too bright.
Yeah, things that make you go,
Well, you know, so he might have laid low for a little bit. And because in 94, just a year later, Perello shows up in Daytona, Florida hospital. So this is another victim, you know, that he's looking for. And he told the staff there that he was trying to kill himself. He overdosed on anti-seizure pills is what he told, you know, the staff there at the hospital. And so this young lady was there and it was her first ever patient, brand new nurse, you know, bright, white, shiny. And she started the job that morning. So Perello faked some seizures. And she said she was so enamored with him that she did not detect his deception. And he was incredibly attractive and intelligent is what she told the authorities. So Perello asked her for a ride from where he was at to Orlando. It's about 75 minutes away by vehicle. And so, you know, she was a professional, but she breached all the professional standards. And she said, yes, that she would take him to where he needed to go in Orlando. So they're driving down the highway and he convinces her that the Navy police were after them. And because he went AWOL. So this time, you know, before he was kicked out because he didn't tell about an assault and now he's, you know, he just left. So he's AWOL. So he kidnapped that nurse and they were together for 3 days. And she said she got away because she used his story against him and said, hey, if they're after you, then we need to leave the United States. So you need to go steal a boat so we can escape to the Caymans. Because that sounds like a logical thing to do.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan.
So early the next morning, Perillo, he did exactly what she advised. And he had a .38 caliber pistol with him. And he swam to a yacht and boarded it in Fort Lauderdale. And he held 9 people at gunpoint for a 4-hour standoff that the police ended before anybody got hurt. But he was charged when the police got him and arrested him. He was charged with armed burglary, false imprisonment, attempted murder of a police officer, and aggravated assault with a firearm. So he's charged with all those. Well, when Perello goes to court, he pleads insanity. And he was acquitted of all charges and put back out on the street.
Wow.
And I don't understand that one because I would think that if he pled insanity, he would have to go and at least do some time at an insane asylum or somewhere to get help for that insanity. I didn't know you could just plead insanity and walk out the door.
Yeah, I guess that was the judge's discretion. Now, that Florida incident, that was, I believe, within a year of the Valerie Eric case, you know, where he kidnapped her and beat her. And he was going, and I've seen pictures of him back then. He was good looking back then. Nice looking dude back then, I'll admit. He was using several names. He's used so many names, it's so confusing. So he was using the name Anthony Tony DeCampo at that point. So the two cases, although people were looking for a DeCampo, he was James Perillo on the other case. And so the authorities never connected the dots. And so that played a role.
And that might be why.
It's he confused. He throws up so much dust. It confuses everybody. Dust and charm.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And that be might be the reason that he found his way back to the PCT after that.
Well, Andrea, you wrote in your book, it's astounding to watch a con man's charisma override solid proof of his criminality. And that's a perfect example of somebody he was conning. And I see that over and over again, going to calls of domestic violence. And often the offender is a master manipulator and is very often able to manipulate even the cops, like we were talking about in Kira's case. And then I also wanted to bring this up because you mentioned it too. But back to Kira's case, the prosecutor, and you said there were jurisdictional issues, but they didn't want to bring charges. And one of the reasons why they said was she would be not particularly sympathetic to the juries. And she was with the guy for over 5 months in a long-term situation like that. The juries will think it was a relationship. She could have fled if she wanted. And I say, so what if it was a relationship? Have these people never seen a Dateline? Come on, how do you not know that even if it was a relationship, there are times where you can't leave, they threaten you, and you feel fear for your safety. I still am having a hard time understanding why this guy continued to get away with these crimes.
Well, it's also domestic abuse. If they're in a relationship and she has a mark on her, it's a domestic abuse case. This also recalls the Gabby Petito case outside of Arches, where, you know, she has a mark on her. And I believe he does, too. Arrest them both.
Yes.
Then arrest them both. Keep them both safe. But in that case, she ended up dead. So I am with you when you have these domestic cases, they have marks on them, you know, put them in separate corners, okay, metaphorically, and think and investigate. And if the California authorities during the Kira Moon, the FBI, I'm going to put on the FBI. If the FBI had been paying attention in that California case, they would have seen his history. We were talking about it on Facebook. If amateurs are talking about it on Facebook, then the FBI should be able to know what's going on with that guy. And so now we're going to fast forward because they let him go in California and what happened.
Right. Well, there's another case, maybe his latest case that happened in New Jersey. And can you tell us, you were somewhat instrumental in felony charges eventually being brought to Perillo. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Yes, I can. So as I said, he went off my radar, I want to say it was 2021, September, and he went quiet. Well, the next I hear is some housewife type woman who watches live court TV. She's bored enough, she admits, that she watches live court TV in New Jersey. And she sees the proceedings there, and my Facebook group gets mentioned, missing from the Pacific Crest Trail. So she goes on to my Facebook group. She goes, I just watched live court TV, and James Perillo is in there, and they're talking about your Facebook group. And the prosecutor is using that information to convince the judge not to grant him bail. Well, because what he had did, and there's video online if you Google him, he had kidnapped another woman. That's why he was off the radar. And he had traveled all the way to New Jersey with her. They were holed up in a home in New Jersey. And suddenly she escapes. She runs down the street into a convenience store and then locks the door behind him. And there's a security video of him banging on the door very menacingly, trying to get to her inside that convenience store. That woman is a hero. She survived. From that, he was arrested. in New Jersey State Police. God love them. They took this case serious, and he is now facing over 11 charges. I do not think he is going to squeak past this time.
And I did read at least 7 women have accused him of kidnapping and rape, and 2 of these women said that Perillo had held them captive each for more than a year. And that's not even counting Kira Moon's case. And I don't think that's counting the latest one in New Jersey. I'm not sure, but at least 2 of them, he had them for more than a year.
Yeah, it's a sad, infuriating situation, honestly. You know, when me and others were trying to warn people on Facebook about this guy, we had proof that he was doing this stuff, and people were lecturing us that we were defaming an innocent man. Now we've all been vindicated, and I believe James Perillo is at the end of his violent trail.
At the end of our podcast, every time, you know, we always say something, and Nancy always brings up, if you see something, say something. And I think this is a perfect example of how the messages just traveled on Facebook, and nothing travels faster than a picture too. And people saw something, they said something, and they posted something. Then people like you brought this even further. And hopefully that's going to be what is stopping Perillo from ever kidnapping and raping another woman.
Yes, I'm very optimistic. He's going to do enough time. This time, I mean, maybe 5-10 years from now, we'll be back wondering what he's doing. But
what's definitely one that we want to keep track of, too. I think that every now and then, if we see a new court date or something coming up, who knows when he gets his trial. But hopefully he's not going to plead insanity. I don't know if New Jersey has not guilty by reason of insanity or not. But hopefully he doesn't get out of it this time. Because if he does, there's an awful lot of serial killers in jail that need to be set free.
Yeah. Because they're all insane, right?
Yeah. Well, back to your search efforts for Fowler, O'Sullivan, and Sylvia. There were several instances in your book where you talked about some of the new technology, new search tools that you started using drones or using squinters, and you went on to find others who went missing. I don't know if you want to tell us about that.
Yeah, during the 5 years, I was embedded with a group of amateur searchers who were working hard to find who I call the PCT missing, the 3 young men who went missing while hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And they were working with a drone group, Western States Aerial Search, a nonprofit who was perfecting a new technique of using drones to do on cold cases. And they take the drone and it flies what they call a lawnmower grid back and forth, taking pictures of the landscape. They've got high resolution photos taken from as low as they can fly. These photos are then sent to a team of people who are called squinters. And these squinters squint at computer screens, searching these photos for clues. Now, this technique did not work to date to find the PCT missing, but they have found 4 people using this technique. And in the book, it's a bit of a spoiler, but in the book, I do detail 2 cases, actually, where an individual squinter named Morgan Clements is tediously searching hundreds and thousands of images, and he, you know, in cooperation with Western States Aerial Search, the drone pilots, they solved a case in Joshua Tree National Park and another case in Southern California where they found bones of the missing person. And the families are...
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, the families are grateful. It's hard to get news that your loved one has passed away, but at least you know what happened to them. You know they haven't been murdered, for example. You're able to bury them. You're able to deal with their estate. So solving these cold cases is a huge value.
Well, it gives them closure, too, because it's always the unknown.
Yeah, the unknown is the worst. They call it ambiguous loss, and it's super hard for these families.
Yeah. I'm sure it's hard emotionally and physically on the searchers as well. We kind of touched on that earlier. And the National Park Service, and I know other agencies that are involved in search and rescue have like family liaison officers. And I can just say that's a valuable, very, very important job where you have somebody linking the agency who's that liaison between the family. And it seemed like you had to do that for a long time, just yourself in the position that you were in when you were searching for the missing, the PCT missing.
Yes. And in particular, I got very close to Sally Fowler, who is Chris Sherpa Fowler's stepmom. And she was a real go-getter and was worked really hard to try to solve and investigate her son's case. And I would interview her on a weekly or monthly basis. So I would stay in touch with her and I would go through all these emotional highs and lows with her. What happens is the lead will come in. And the family member will get excited. Maybe this is it. You know, they'll have a lot of mixed feelings. Maybe it's going to be their body, right? But I'm going to know what happened. And it's like a weird high. And then if the lead, it turns out to be nothing, they have what's called a hope hangover. And it's hard on them. And then it's like a depression after the lead is closed. And so I would go through these highs and lows with Sally. And I was honored to do so. But it is hard for... you know, the writer or the ranger who is in there with the family, helping them navigate this intense emotional crisis.
Nancy and I were also talking before we did this podcast based on, you know, discussing stuff with you previously. And I think that's something like for, at least for me, family liaison officers, I've been trained in that. I've done that before. And it is incredibly difficult for me on those cases where they're prolonged searches or body recoveries. And for some reason, that makes me squirm. I've worked my last 5 years in the National Park Service with victims of crime, victims of domestic violence, sexual assaults, and homicides. And for whatever reason, mentally, emotionally, I can handle that. But dealing with the prolonged search and, like you said, the hope and then for it to dissipate is just too hard for me. And so I got to the point where I just would refuse going to those. That just was something that I couldn't do.
Have you ever heard of the term grief sponge?
No.
Yeah, it's what we used to say. That we used to call I don't mean to make light of it. I'm not doing that at all. In fact, quite the opposite. We would sometimes call the family liaison the grief sponge. And so it is tiring. Like I said, I'm a nurse. I'm honored to be there for people. I pride myself on having the emotional courage to sit with them with whatever crisis they're dealing with at the time. But with that said, I also have to take care of myself, and writing this book did exhaust me.
I bet.
And I still communicate with families in the missing, and I try my best to help them. But it is exhausting at times, and I need to take breaks.
Absolutely. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I could never be, I'm like Tara. I can do the quick ones that if somebody has a heart attack and doesn't make it or things like that. Yeah. But to do the prolonged one and being with the family all the time and updating them, I'd also have a hard time doing that.
Yeah, it can be rewarding as well, though, and I think that's where I get I feel good by being hopefully some source of small comfort for these people.
Right. Well, you put in your book at the end something that you and your search partner, Kathy, which I hope people buy your book because it was really fun, I guess, and enlightening listening to how you told stories that Kathy was involved. I really enjoyed reading that. But what you said struck a chord with me. You wrote, 2 years later, despite all of your search efforts focused on finding Sylvia Fowler and O'Sullivan, the answers about what exactly happened to the PCT missing evaded you still. And then you said, quote, do you see some sort of greater purpose at hand? And Kathy said, yes, definitely a greater purpose here. And if you look at everything that went wrong, oh my goodness, it was also we could help other people in the future. End quote. So can you talk about how you and Kathy and others involved in the search efforts on the PCT have already seen those instances of what that greater purpose has brought forward?
Yes. And Kathy Tarr, I met her early on. And actually, once I met her, that's when the book was born. because she was an amateur searcher. She had no experience, no law enforcement experience. She was a pharmacy manager for Walgreens prior to this. But she,
wow.
She's still out there doing this as we speak. And she has such emotional and courage and bravery. And I was so inspired by her. And so I would follow her as she tried to find also all three of the missing. And she, especially David O'Sullivan, the Irishman. And she, I bet she also would be, is still to this day, a comfort to families of the missing. But Kathy is, I'm a little jaded. You know, you guys can relate, right? I am a little jaded, but Kathy, it can be Pollyanna in a good way. She reminds me of Mary Poppins. You know, she's here to fix things, right? She's going to get things out of her bag and fix things. So she's a delightful personality. And so when I asked her that question and she came up with that, she's right. We learn things. The drone guys got better at their search technique. Morgan Clements, the squinter, continues to find missing hikers using this technique. There's a foundation was created, the Fowler Sullivan Foundation, named after David Sullivan and Chris Fowler. And that foundation is also doing PSAR efforts to try to prevent.
Interesting.
Yes, they have a Garmin InReach giveaway. They also give away micro spikes in an area of the trail where walking in the snow is a problem, has led to fatalities. So this group is continuing to do positive things, and also the relationships. We're all friends. We count on one another and trust one another. And so a lot of positive stuff did come from a lot of the horrible stuff and the frustration that we dealt with over the years of trying to find the PCT missing.
And it sadly, sometimes those tragedies do happen, and most of the time there is something, thankfully, good that does come out of these situations. It's not always what you want or expect, but usually there's some glimmer of hope or hopefully some silver lining coming out of these things. And then I did want to say, when I was reading this book, it didn't read like a nonfiction book, you know, spewing out facts. It read like a story. I was telling Nancy, I got to where I was reading faster and faster. So I did miss a lot of things because I'm trying to get to, okay, what was the outcome of this thing? What happened next? And so I was reading it pretty fast, but I will say, just anybody that's interested in buying this book and reading it, it doesn't read like a typical boring nonfiction book. It reads like a story.
Yeah, that's my goal with creative nonfiction, is for it to all be real, intensive fact checking, to do all the interviews, but to bring to life the real life people, to show their characters, to show the hardships they face and the courage they show, and to do that through storytelling, just like when you read a novel.
So, Andrea, what do you want our listeners or readers to take away from your book?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I want people to take away from it. I would love for somebody that knows something that maybe doesn't know about the cases to come forward and bring a new lead that we can follow. I would love for hikers to read it and go, the trail's not Disneyland. So I need to be prepared. So I'd love for it to have a PSAR effect. I would love the families of the missing to... it's hard for them maybe to read, but for them to find some comfort in it. People do care. There are people out there who care about your missing loved one and would work very hard to try to help you find them. I also would like to see search techniques improve. I'm going to do a talk with a state agency soon, and I'm real hopeful about that, to share the lessons that I learned when writing Trail of the Lost with search officials. I also hope that it's also a story of resilience, that maybe we won't solve every mystery, but we can still find meaning in it and have a positive outcome in another arena.
Mm-hmm. So at the end of our podcast, we always say, Terry will say, stay safe in wild places. Can you give us some suggestions on some additional pros or tips that people embarking on an outdoor adventure can have?
Yeah, every environment is different and unique. And so I like to say, have an expedition mindset when you go out and check the weather. You know, that means have a safety plan. What am I going to do if something goes wrong? Mm-hmm. And it could be as simple as, what am I going to do if it rains? I'm going to have a jacket in my pack, right? So what if I do right. if I get lost? I have extra food and I know where I can get cell service, things like that. So if you have an expedition mindset versus just, I'm going to go out on a hike, I think that can help prevent an accident from going really south on you.
So, Andrea, where can people buy your book?
It's available everywhere, all your favorite bookstores, online, anywhere that you buy books.
Excellent.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much, Andrea, again.
Yeah, thank you.
Being on the show with us. I really appreciate it. And, you know, sometimes, because, you know, what we talked about today was a little intense, and maybe this is not so bad compared to some really graphic cases Nancy and I have covered, but we try to end with something a little bit funny. What do you call a criminal who goes camping?
Oh my gosh.
Criminal?
I don't know.
Criminal intent.
Oh. Oh, I like that one. That's a new one on me. Perillo is definitely a criminal intent.
Yes.
Yes.
He was in multiple tents. Okay, well, that's it for this episode. Stay safe in wild places and watch out for the company you keep.
And if you see something, say something.
That's right.